Good day, and welcome to the Mississippi Medicaid Work Requirement Press Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during a question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone telephone. Today's conference may be recorded, and I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Phyllis Jordan from Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for joining us today. I'm, as she said, from the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown, and we're glad you could all be here to talk about the report we're releasing with our Mississippi partners about the impact the proposed Medicaid work requirement would have on parents and their children in Mississippi. Joan Alker, who's the director of our center here at Georgetown, is going to start out with an overview of what our analysis found, and then we'll hear from Roy Mitchell, Linda Rigsby, and Charles Taylor from various Mississippi groups. So, Joan?
Thank you, Phyllis, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. I'm going to just do a quick overview of the national landscape on these types of Medicaid waivers, and then I'll turn to review the findings of the new report. So, as been pretty highly publicized, on January 11th, the Trump administration, through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, released new guidance announcing its interest in approving state proposals to impose a work requirement on Medicaid beneficiaries. This is a sharp policy CMS. It's something that's never happened before. Since that announcement, CMS has approved three states that are imposing a work requirement: Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas. Those waivers do include other important and harmful changes, such as lockouts, which we're not talking about today, but I just wanted to flag that. But it's important to note that all three of those states I just mentioned, Kentucky, Indiana, and Arkansas, have accepted the Affordable Care Act Medicaid funding to expand their program to adults below 138% of the federal poverty line. Mississippi, as you know, has not accepted Medicaid funding to expand their program. And so far, the Trump administration has not yet responded to impose a work requirement in a state like Mississippi that has not expanded Medicaid under the ACA. And that's what we're releasing our report about today. The bottom line is that in states that have not expanded Medicaid, these proposals are being will negatively impact families with children only, and these families with children that would be harmed are some of the most vulnerable in the country with extremely low incomes. A few other states, Kansas and Maine, have similar requests pending before the federal government, though for a variety of reasons, these waivers may not move forward in their current form. Mississippi's neighbor Alabama just completed the public state comment period on a very similar proposal to Mississippi's, but Mississippi's proposal, which we're discussing today, has already been through both the state and federal public comment process. The federal process ended on February 22nd. So Mississippi is ahead of Alabama in the queue, and to my mind, Mississippi's proposal as a result is the key one to watch to see what happens. So let's talk quickly now about their proposal. The proposal itself seeks to impose a work or community service requirement on parents with incomes at or below 27% of the federal poverty line. These are families with income of no more than $468 a month for a family of three. That is Mississippi's eligibility level for parents. The proposal does include some exemptions, but they're very poorly defined, such as being a primary caregiver for a person who cannot care for himself or herself. It's not clear what this means with respect to children, for example, in which parents will be exempt. Further, the proposal exempts persons receiving treatment for cancer, but not persons receiving treatment for other serious conditions such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes. The state of Mississippi argues that the proposal is an opportunity to, quote, increase participants' ability to obtain and maintain employment and employer-sponsored health care, slow down the rising cost of health care spending, and familiarize individuals with private health insurance practices. However, I believe this proposal will not accomplish any of those objectives, but it will result in thousands of parents indeed 5,000 almost in the first year alone, according to analysis of the state's own numbers, will lose their Medicaid coverage and most likely become uninsured. The state has requested federal Medicaid funds for job training activities, but the Trump administration guidance is very clear that federal Medicaid funds will not be available for these activities. As such, the proposal itself will really do nothing to address the many barriers that low-income women face in getting jobs, particularly in areas of the state that have very high rates of unemployment. So let's turn now to the findings of the report. Who are these families that will be affected? So our analysis found the vast majority are women, head of households, 91%. They're very much more likely to be African American, 71%, and they're more likely to live in rural areas and small towns, which have higher rates of Medicaid enrollment than metropolitan areas. About half of these parents are not in the workforce because they are caring for a child or someone with a disability. Some of them are already working, and only one-third describe themselves as unemployed. The second point I wanted to make, which is rarely discussed, that children, too, will be harmed by this proposal. That is for a number of reasons. When parents lose coverage, we know that children are at risk for three key reasons. As their parents become uninsured, the entire family is at risk for medical debt and even bankruptcy, moving these families in the opposite direction of economic self-sufficiency. Families at this very low-income level we're talking about today already experience very high levels of homelessness and residential instability, and they have higher rates of health problems. Secondly, a healthier parent is a better parent, and so losing health coverage will create additional barriers to things like treatment for depression. Medicaid has been shown clearly to reduce the incidence of depression, and maternal depression is epidemic among very low-income women. When a mom has maternal depression, this inhibits parent-child bonding, particularly in the critical early years of development. And finally, as parents become uninsured themselves, research is clear that children may follow. While an insured parent almost never has an uninsured child, but a parent that doesn't have coverage raises the odds the child, too, will be uninsured. This is particularly troubling because our analysis found that in Mississippi, these very poor children living at or below 27% of the poverty line targeted by this proposal already have a substantially higher uninsured rate of 6.6% as compared to the state's overall rate of 4.5% uninsured kids. In conclusion, I would just note that a recent examination we did of the public comments that the federal government received about Mississippi's proposal shows that not a single that supported the state's proposal, but a wide diversity of groups, including the American College of Physicians, the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Children's Defense Fund, to name a few, all oppose approval of this proposal because they believe it will be very harmful to these very poor families in Mississippi. And with that, I'll hand it back to Phyllis.
Thanks, Jen, for that great overview. Now we're going to hear from Roy Mitchell, who's Executive Director of the Mississippi Health Advocacy Program. The program combines research, analysis, and grassroots organizing to help improve health policies, practices, and funding in Mississippi. Thanks for joining us today, Roy.
You're welcome. Thank you, Phyllis. As Phyllis said, I am director of the Mississippi Health Advocacy Program, and we want to highlight that this work requirement creates a catch-22 for Mississippi's most vulnerable parents. Mississippi has proposed that Medicaid consumers must work 20 hours a week to receive Medicaid. However, if they do work 20 hours a week at minimum wage, they will make too much to qualify for Medicaid and too little to qualify for tax credits in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. So either way, they lose Medicaid coverage, and they will likely not be making enough to afford private insurance. As Joan said, right now, the only parents who qualify for Medicaid in Mississippi have very, very low incomes. They make 27% of the poverty rate, which is roughly $5,544 a year, or about $468 a month. If they don't work 20 hours a week or participate in work-related activities, they lose their Medicaid coverage. If they work 20 hours a week, they make too much to qualify for Medicaid. For example, our consumer assistance program, Health Help, typically provides insurance eligibility assistance to women like Jane. Jane is a single mother with children ages 5, 8, and 10. Jane is working a part-time job working 20 hours a week at $7.25 an hour. If Jane works 20 hours per week at minimum wage, her monthly earnings would equal $580, above Mississippi's income limit of $468 per month for Medicaid eligibility for a family of that size. Mississippi itself projects that 8% of parents subject to the work requirement, including single women like Jane, would lose coverage within the first year of implementation. Most of these parents would become uninsured because the low-wage jobs they'd likely get may not offer health insurance. In fact, less than a quarter of Mississippi's low-income workers receive insurance through their employer. Also, the low-income wage incomes would not pay enough to raise their income above the poverty line so that they could qualify for premium tax credits to help them pay for coverage in the health insurance marketplaces. They will more than likely become uninsured. Hence, the proposed work requirement won't achieve its stated goal of greater employment. It will just leave more Mississippi women like Jane without the health coverage they need. Thank you, Phyllis.
Thanks, Roy, for that very interesting analysis. Now we're going to hear from Linda Dixon Rigsby at Mississippi Center for Justice. The Mississippi Center is a nonprofit public law firm committed to advancing racial and economic justice. Thanks for joining us today, Linda.
Thank you, Phyllis. Good morning. My name is Linda Dixon Rigsby, and I'm the Health Law Director at the Mississippi Center for Justice. And I would just like to highlight that if the federal government approves Mississippi's waiver, the state, Mississippi, will be among the first, if not one of the first, to do a work requirement without having expanded Medicaid. And as Joan previously stated, the states of Arkansas, Kentucky, and Indiana have been granted approval to implement a work requirement, but all three states have expanded Medicaid to adults making up to 138% of the federal poverty level, and Mississippi has not expanded Medicaid. And that's a crucial thing to look at in terms of distinguishing ourselves from these other states. The only Mississippi families affected by the proposed change would be those living at 27% of the federal poverty level or even lower. And we're talking about $5,610 a year for a family of three. And this is roughly $468 a month. There's no reason Mississippi has to be out front on this issue without exploring everything fully. We don't know what the administrative cost of verifying this work requirement will be. This unknown variable and the negative impact this could have on vulnerable families and children isn't in the best interest of Mississippians. We don't know what the impact will be. So why risk the health and well-being of Mississippi children and families to implement a work requirement that creates greater vulnerability to these families and children, and is counterproductive and costly? We've found when parents are insured, it is more likely their children will be insured. What we do know is that the parents affected by this already face a number of challenges to working. The kind of jobs they find don't tend to be full-time and don't have benefits. They work often, the work is often seasonal or temporary. A lot of these parents often lack access to affordable child care and transportation they need and to find and keep a job. The state has said they will provide more job training, but there's no guarantee of more money for these priorities, and that's concerning. Mississippi also wants to apply the work requirement to people who get health coverage through the Transitional Medical Assistance Program, or TMA. TMA provides up to a year of health coverage to people who no longer qualify for Medicaid because they've increased their earnings. TMA is a powerful incentive for people to work more without having to fear they will become uninsured. But now Mississippi wants to make it harder for residents to maintain this coverage as their earnings increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. That was very interesting. Now we'll hear from Charles Taylor, who works in civic engagement for One Voice, which is a nonprofit that focuses on education, voting rights, and other issues to help vulnerable Mississippi families. Thanks for joining us, Charles.
Thank you. I just wanted to echo some of the sentiments that Joan mentioned. The numbers that Joan reflect, the numbers that Joan gave reflect the disparities. 91% of parents who rely on Medicaid and for health care are women in Mississippi, and 71% are African American. This is going to hit Mississippi small towns and rural communities the hardest because that's where women and children are more likely to rely on Medicaid. About 16% of adults in small towns and rural communities are covered by Medicaid compared to the 12% in metro areas. For children, 60% of the children in rural areas and small towns are covered by Medicaid compared to the 46% in the metro areas. Certain parts of Mississippi are going to be hit harder. About 22% of adults living in the Delta region rely on Medicaid compared to the 12% in the Jackson metro area and the 13% in the Tupelo region. Jobs are scarce in these regions and also support services. Mississippi can't afford to leave any of these families behind. And lastly, I'll say that this is not going to achieve the goal that we're seeking, which is better employment. Instead, it's going to hurt the economic viability of Mississippi communities by leaving more parents without insurance and creating more medical debt for our families. Thank you.
Thanks, Charles. Do we have any questions?
Do we want to have the operators ask?
Yeah.
Queue up the questions and give the instructions.
Great.
Certainly. As a reminder, it is the star and one to ask a question via the phone line. If you find your question has been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Again, star and one. And we do have a question. We'll go to Larison Campbell from Mississippi Today.
Hey, thanks so much. So, just to be clear, and I know that this is kind of a nebulous thing, y'all don't really know exactly, because it just hasn't been well-defined, who's going to be affected by this, but to me, the way the rules are written, because it's so hard already for people to have, for adults to get Medicaid in Mississippi, and caregivers are technically exempted from this, I mean, who exactly is going to be, can you kind of give me a better picture of who exactly will be affected by this, like how there's sort of like what the loopholes are that, you know, since caregivers are technically exempted, those seem to be the people most at risk of losing coverage. How could that happen?
So this is Joan Alkridge-Richardson, and I will jump in and then additional thoughts. So by definition, and when you read the waiver request, the state identifies two populations that will be impacted by these requirements. The first population is parents at or below 27% of poverty. The second population is the group Linda just mentioned. Those are folks, parents receiving transitional medical assistance. Essentially those, mostly women, as we have seen in our analysis, they have some increase in their earned income, so they're already doing what the state wants to happen, which means they're having more earned income, so their income's going over the 27%, and they can get Medicaid for up to a year to help them transition. So it really makes no sense to include that second population because they're literally already doing what the state wants to happen. So as you mentioned, of course, this proposal, like most of these proposals, does include some exemptions. I know I've seen press reports of the state saying that at the end of the day, they think this will affect about 15,000 to 20,000 of these very low-income parents. We gave you the demographics today of who those parents are. much more likely to be women, 91% women, much more likely to be African American, and higher levels of concentration living in rural areas and small towns. Those are the folks that are going to be disproportionately hit by this, the parents, and then I outlined some of the ways in which their children are also at risk. There's nobody else that will be impacted by this because that is the only group in Mississippi, because there's no Medicaid expansion. By definition, this has to target those parents. So while some of them technically may be exempted, the proposal is not clear about how that will happen and who those parents will be. And quite frankly, when these kinds of proposals are rolled out, there's a lot of red tape, and we know that folks will fall through the cracks, even if they technically might qualify for an exemption, whatever paperwork they have to provide to comply with that. Some of them just aren't going to make it, particularly if you're in a small, if you're in the rural area, if you're in the Delta, you don't have great internet access. We know folks are going to fall through the cracks. But the bottom line is, the population that will be impacted are those that we outline here in our analysis. They're mostly women. They're more likely to be African American. They're extremely poor, below 27% of the poverty line, and they're more likely to be living in rural areas.
Great, thank you. And so that was kind of my follow-up question was, so you really think that this is actually, it could be sort of more of a technicality that, like, for this first population of people, not the people who receive the TMA, who receive TMA insurance, but the first population really could actually just be sort of technicalities, more steps to go through, more having to prove that you're sort of in this caretaker population, and that will ultimately cost people insurance. So they could be technically eligible, but they wind up not,
No, it's even worse than that. And bear in mind that the state's own waiver application, if you analyze the budget neutrality, they don't say it this way, but when you do the math, it's showing they expect about 5,000 parents a year to lose coverage. So, but as Roy talked about, and Roy, please jump in here, there's a catch-22 in this proposal. Literally, if you comply with the work requirement, you're going to be over-eligible for Medicaid and you're going to lose it. And if you don't comply, you're going to get kicked off. So it's going to be virtually impossible eventually for any of these parents to qualify. So, Roy, do you want to add to that?
Yes, and I'd also like to add that, as I pointed out, that Mississippi is not a Medicaid expansion state. So if you did start, you know, getting a job and making this low-wage income, you more than likely are not going to make enough to qualify for tax credits in the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And these are just some of the issues that problematic issues for consumers in Mississippi, where we're a non-expansion state and no one has done this in a non-expansion state. This is a pretty dramatic change to eligibility in Mississippi, on par with cutting the plaid during the Barber administration. There is going to be a lot of fallout from this. As Joan said, there's going to be bureaucratic red tape, and a lot of people are going to be caught in that red tape to their detriment.
Great, thank you.
And again, that is the star and one if you'd like to ask a question. And we'll pause momentarily for further questions. Thank you.
This is Phyllis. The conversation you just had brought to mind that this is a statutory requirement that this population of parents be covered. So is there a concern that the way this is set up is in violation of federal law, and is there any legal effort in Mississippi to address that?
I'll do a quick response, and then folks in Mississippi join in. So, yes, we, as many of you are probably aware, the state of Kentucky, which was the first state to have a work requirement approved, That litigation has been filed in federal court, and that litigation is proceeding. That I would expect that if Mississippi's waiver was approved and implemented, that there would be litigation about this. And as Phyllis says, this is a mandatory population Medicaid statute, unlike the expansion population, which as a result of the Supreme Court decision has essentially been rendered an optional population. States have to cover these low-income parents. So anybody else want to add to that? Okay.
Apologies. We did have a follow-up from Larison Campbell.
Hey, thank you. So my other question is, you know, we've talked about women being proportionally more heard, and this is sort of more a statistical thing. And if you said this and I missed it in my note-taking, I apologize. But do you have the numbers percentage-wise on how many more women are caretakers versus men in the state? Within the Medicaid population, that is.
Oh, so the analysis that we did found that 91% of
That's
parents
right.
who rely on Medicaid in your very low eligibility group, 27% of poverty, are women.
Okay.
Thank you. And we do have another question. We'll go to Anna Wolf from Clarence Ledger. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I guess I'm just wondering, we don't know what the response is from the federal government or from CMS on this yet. Do you have any idea on the viability of this proposal?
So that's a great question. You're absolutely right. There's no response yet. And as I mentioned, Mississippi could be the first state where the Trump administration has to decide if they are going to say yes and allow the state to impose a work requirement in a non-expansion setting, as Roy was describing. So this could happen any day. I don't expect it to happen immediately. We haven't heard rumors of that. But the proposal itself has gone through the full process that is required by law, which includes state public comment and federal public comment. That has been all done for Mississippi. So it is ready for the Trump administration to render a decision. What they will decide, I don't know. If I had to guess, I would guess that they will approve this. But I don't know that for sure.
So you make the point that, you know, Mississippi is unique in this way. It seems to me like fewer people are at risk of losing their insurance in Mississippi than in other states where the, you know, where Medicaid was expanded. So could you kind of elaborate on why it's, you know, even more extreme, an even more extreme proposal in Mississippi, if that makes
yes.
sense?
Yes. I mean, it's only fewer people because Mississippi is covering so few people to start with.
Right.
You know, these expansion states like Kentucky that added, you know, 300,000-400,000 people to their Medicaid program. So Mississippi is doing the absolute bare minimum today. They're doing only what the federal law requires them to do in covering these women up to 27% and their children of poverty. Children are covered at higher income levels. But for the parents, that's it. And I think one of the frustrations from my perspective is that a lot of the discussions around this work requirement in a state like Mississippi, nobody talks about parents and children, but that's who it is. That's who we're talking about. It is families. It is these very poor families that are disproportionately African American. So there's a lot of verbiage thrown about, oh, it's going to be our able-bodied adults. Well, who are we talking about? In a non-expansion state, we're talking about these extremely poor parents, and that's it. So our families who already are in very difficult circumstances, they have a lot of residential instability, they have higher rates of health problems to begin with, and to take away their health insurance is going to set them back further. In fact, I would have the opposite effect of the intention of the program. We all agree that working is a terrible goal. But taking away somebody's health insurance, particularly for a population that's more likely to have health problems, in my judgment, make them less likely to work, not more. Providing them with health insurance helps them to try to move back into the workforce, not the other way around. Does anybody else want to comment on that?
I do have a follow-up question. You said that Alabama is the only is Alabama the only other state that has an expanded Medicaid that's also in line for a work requirement?
So Alabama is, but Kansas and Maine, I mentioned in my introductory remarks, I sort of glossed over them. So they have submitted this request as well. However, they're in a little bit of different state for two reasons. Maine passed Medicaid expansion by a ballot initiative, so there's some wrangling over that right now with the governor, but at the end of the day, they're going to have Medicaid expansion. So that puts Maine into a different category. Kansas have a request pending, but the legislature has indicated that they are not happy with the request, and I believe there's legislation moving through on Kansas so that that waiver is essentially on hold. So that puts Mississippi right to the top of the list as potentially the first state, a non-expansion state, where the Trump administration will render a judgment on this question.
Okay. One more question just to piggyback off of Larry's question. Can you give me, like, a description of the type of person who, you know, would lose their, besides a woman and caretaker, I mean, is it a woman whose child is 15 years old, for example, and, you know, goes to school? I guess I'm trying to kind of picture who it is that we're talking about, considering that there is that exemption for caretakers. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and let me turn to folks in the state. I can comment on that, but I want to let others jump in.
Sure.
Well, as I highlighted in my presentation, you know, typically we're talking about people that are trying to work, working part-time, this is, again, it's the catch-22 situation where they're put in a situation where if they make over a certain amount, they're going to be deemed ineligible for the program. And, you know, again, Mississippi is a non-expansion state. There's this myth out there that by people working that they will be able to obtain health insurance in the private market. They don't make enough to qualify for the tax credits. Low-income jobs do not provide health insurance. We all agree work is good, but there's this whole proposal is promoted as a way to promote work and promote getting private health insurance. And again, many times the jobs don't exist, especially in rural areas, and the health insurance that's provided by these jobs don't exist. And I'll let Jane talk a little bit more about who is exactly impacted.
This is Joan. I'll jump back in. But Linda or Charles, did you want to add anything, or I can just make a couple additional comments? Okay.
No, I'm deferring to you, Joan.
Okay. So I was just going to say, typically this is going to be a mom, right, with two children on Medicaid. As we mentioned, this mom is more likely to live in the Delta area. More likely to live in a rural area of the state. And I'll just give an example that came up when we were doing a similar report about Alabama. A mom who had two children, middle-aged, but pretty young, and one of them had mild autism. So this required her to go to school a lot to address a lot of behavioral issues that were coming up with the child. And as a result, even though, you know, she's not technically a full-time caregiver for this child because the child was able to attend school, managing her son's question took an enormous amount of time and energy. So there are lots of families, circumstances, who will challenges, and the reality is we can say, okay, maybe they're going to exempt parents of children or under three or under five. We don't really know yet, but families still are going to have to go through the application process exemption. And when that, that people fall through the cracks, and those attend to fall that are already the most maybe have no access to the internet, little access to the internet, they don't have a lot of transportation, and these paperwork requirements are intense. So there are all kinds of problems here, and the state itself is fairly explicit in saying they want to do this to cut their costs, and the way they're going to cut their costs is by cutting these parents off Medicaid. They actually acknowledge in the proposal, to highlight a point Linda made, that administrative costs are likely to go up as a result. So unfortunately, they're not required to explain how their administrative costs will go up. I would agree with them that they will go up, but that's something that it would be important to pin the state down, because potentially we're going to see more money spent on red tape and administrative costs while parents are losing coverage, and this will harm their children as well. So that, in my judgment, is not a wise use of taxpayer dollars.
So one more follow-up, sorry. The state's going to come back and say that, you know, this isn't an attempt to kick people off the rolls. They can also volunteer, right, and maintain coverage that way. Can you explain or speak to, like, what it means to have a voluntary a requirement for volunteer work that does not make money just to keep Medicaid or just to keep your health insurance?
So let me,
because Roy mentioned the catch-22, but that wouldn't apply if the person decided to just do volunteer work or, you know, community service, whatever the other requirement is. Go ahead, sorry.
Right. I'm going to come back to that, but I wanted to respond to your first comment. The state itself, if you read their budget neutrality assumptions, so that's sort of all the math and the tables in the back of the proposal, they're doing, it's called a per member per month analysis, and this is typical for budget neutrality in any state Section 1115 waiver. But their own assumptions show thousands and thousands of these parents losing coverage. So we only essentially took their numbers and divided by 12 to get an annual. In fact, a lot more people are probably going to be impacted over the course of a year as these parents turn on and off. So
yeah.
We're not, you know, we're using their own data to suggest that thousands of parents are losing coverage. We are not making this up ourselves. So anyway, I'll let Roy answer the volunteer question. I can jump in on that too, but Roy, let me turn to you.
As you noted, the work-related activities that they're proposing in their waiver includes, as you said, working 20 hours a week, volunteering, or participating in an alcohol or other drug abuse treatment. I don't really know how that scenario works out with the volunteering. I wondered that myself. I don't know if that was Anna that asked the question. I don't have a whole lot of insight in it, and I think that would be a good question for the Division of Medicaid.
I mean, I guess my point is that they're not going to be making money doing that. So
right. Right, and that's a fair point. They won't be caught in the catch-22, but I think potentially they will be, first of all, caught in a paperwork snafu. The waiver itself says volunteering with approved agencies, so I don't think we know anything about who are these approved agencies, and do they want volunteers for 20 hours a week? There's a lot of questions, and I can tell you in Kentucky, which has a similar kind of aspect to its work requirement, there was a lot of concern among a lot of the nonprofits and the charitable organizations that this really wasn't going to work, and they were very concerned about essentially being forced in this difficult position where they had to figure out how to take, in their case, obviously a lot more people with the expansion, at the risk of them losing their health care if they didn't. It put them in a very awkward position.
I would think you would still have the child care issue, too, if you were volunteering. It's not like this child care is magically going to appear.
Right. True.
This is Linda. That's the point I made in my comments, is that, you know, these parents often lack access to affordable child care, and transportation is an issue, especially in the Delta.
Yeah.
Although as volunteer, you still have those two very crucial things that parents must be concerned about, you know, with the care of their children and how they're going to get to and from, whether it's a volunteer scenario or work.
Yeah. Okay, that's it for me. Thanks, guys. I'm going to get off.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have another follow-up from Larison Campbell.
Hey, this is my last question, too. So can you talk just a little bit about where this is coming from, sort of like the history of this requirement? I know it was proposed last year, but had this been talked about for a long time? Is this something that Republicans are trying to get through in Congress and obviously couldn't with President Obama? Sort of like where did this come from?
I'll answer the national, and then I'm going to turn to my colleagues in the state to elucidate that answer. This came up a few times in the Obama administration. There were a couple of states, Pennsylvania being one, that was doing the expansion, maybe wanted to do a work requirement. And the Obama administration was open to negotiating around, you know, trying to improve job referral activities and things like that. What they were not, what they did not find acceptable, and what has changed now, is that this work requirement conditions Medicaid eligibility on compliance. So it's a stick, right? So losing your eligibility because you don't comply is where the Obama administration was not willing to go, and that's where the Trump administration has gone. We do hear about the work requirement sometimes potentially coming up in Congress, and I think it might have been in one of the House repeal bills, if I'm remembering correctly. So it has been sort of floating around in some circles for a while. But I'll turn to folks in the state to respond more specifically about Mississippi. Troy or Linda, do you want to respond with any history there of the work requirement?
No, other than that, you know, there's been a long succession of hearings about cutting costs within the Medicaid program, and most of those proposals were pretty extreme, and I think this falls in line with most of the proposals that came out of those Medicaid committee hearings.
Okay, thanks. Any final questions?
I show no further questions at this time.
Oh, this is Phyllis. Thanks, everybody, for participating. The report is on Mississippi's Medicaid work requirement is on our website, which is www.ccf.georgetown.edu. We'll also have a tape of this call in the next day or so. So look for it there. Thanks for joining us.